It's hard to remember now, but the internet used to be fun.
I can't believe how easy it is to surf the net.
Surf's up.
On Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet, we'll trace how a tool that once fueled democracy...
Opposition activists organized the march on Facebook.
...became a weapon aimed at the very heart of it.
You're watching the unraveling of our democracy right now.
From Longlead and PRX, this is Long Shadow, Breaking the Internet. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Drone technology is developing fast, and the implications are bigger than we know.
We are still waking up to the threat this poses for assassinations, for policing issues, in future conflicts.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, how drone technology is changing the face of war and much more. Also on the show, widespread protests in the West African nation of Togo. The demands of demonstrators are pretty simple.
To put an end to the oldest military regime in Africa.
Also, a new tipping point pushes more human rights advocates from El Salvador, plus a legendary South African bassist from Paul Simon's Graceland band looks back on it all.
I want to go distance. I don't want to just be a South African bass player. Paul came through.
Those stories and much more coming up today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here this Friday. Carolyn Beeler is off today. Something we've been hearing about a lot lately.
A daring drone offensive.
Waves of drone attacks.
A barrage of more than 300 drones.
Drones, or in military speak, UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. Their use is ramping up in Russia and Ukraine. Just yesterday, both countries exchanged drone attacks after peace talks failed again. But authorities far and wide are using drones. This week alone, conflict drones have been deployed in Thailand, Haiti, northern Iraq. It's a technological revolution in real time, one that could change not just how countries fight wars, but how they get into them in the first place. We begin our show today with Rob Lee. He's a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and joined us earlier today from Kyiv.
Well, they're being used pretty much everywhere, and I think it makes sense for a lot of reasons. So, you know, the different class of drones, some of the things, you know, we're talking about with Iran and Israel, Iran was using these kind of large Shahed-type one-way attack UAVs. Russia uses those against Ukraine, often against infrastructure, and these are very large military-style UAVs with very long ranges. But you also have a lot of commercially available cheap UAVs that they can use and are pretty easy to put together, like first-person view drones, which are used in Ukraine. Those are being used elsewhere as well. There are obviously applications for terrorist groups could use this, paramilitary groups. I think it's likely we're going to see attempts at assassinations with FPVs because they're cheap, because they have quite good range compared to other military weapons, and because it's commercially available. I think we're going to see this in almost all conflicts going forward, whether it's a conventional fight between two large militaries or just between, you know, paramilitary groups or even criminal gangs in the future.
Yeah, UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, and we've also seen them in Haiti. How does the picture change for civilians in war zones as unmanned aerial vehicles take on a bigger presence during wartime?
One of the big changes in this war for the last couple of years is that the area that's dangerous near the front line has expanded dramatically. So earlier in the war, you know, if you were maybe 5 kilometers past the front line, the risk was obviously there, but it was kind of reduced. But now FPVs, these little UAVs, often operate 20 kilometers or greater. But if you have better units, they could be operating 30, 40 kilometers.
Well, you're joining us from Kyiv. Have you had any personal experience with that?
Fortunately, not myself, but when you drive anywhere near the front line, and I was around the front line last week, we don't go nearly as close to the front line as we used to when we try and visit units. Security precautions are greater, and some of the roads, even far from the front line, are now under much greater threat than they used to be.
So where exactly were you on the front lines, and what stood out to you about the role of drones where you were?
So we were in different places. We went to Kharkiv. We were up in the Kupiansk area, in Liman. I'd say one of the really important developments is that Ukraine really innovated with using commercial UAVs first, and they did that partially to compensate for lack of ammunition for artillery. But now, increasingly, it's to compensate for lack of manpower. Russia has a significant advantage in infantry, and Ukraine uses UAVs to kind of compensate for that. But one of the things that's happened more recently is that Russia has started to innovate with UAVs as well. They have some quite capable UAV units, and they're scaling a lot of their activities. And one of the things that often is common in the front line is when Russia deploys one of these elite units called the Rubicon Center to a part of the front line, the situation will often become much more difficult for Ukrainian units there. It becomes more difficult for Ukrainian UAV units to operate there, but also more difficult for infantry to get logistics to the front line. And so in many cases, when Russia is advancing, it's because they are reinforcing parts of the front line with their better strike UAV units. The UAV to UAV fight is going to be a key factor in how well Ukraine can hold back Russian advances, or you know, how far can Russia advance.
So it sounds like the drone war is evolving as quickly as it looks from the headlines.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you know, if you come to the front line every month, the tactics will change. It's a constant fight for adaptation because little advantages with UAVs can have a significant effect on the battlefield. And you know, again, that's really where the innovation is happening: unmanned aerial vehicles, but also unmanned ground vehicles.
I'm speaking with Rob Lee, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's in Kyiv. So the U.S. and others are still sending tanks. We should point that out. It's not like this is an entirely a drone war. It is striking, though, that just 3 years ago, the picture from Ukraine was one of tanks getting stuck in mud, and now there's this greater reliance on drones. That can't be coincidental.
No, it's not. And, you know, FPVs, these cheap UAVs, are quite effective at targeting armor, not just tanks, but kind of old vehicles, right? They can be used against people on ATVs. They can be used against light trucks, light armored vehicles, you know, tanks, and so on, because they move fast enough. And you can identify these vehicles ahead of time with UAVs, then you can target them. And so the role has changed. Tanks are still useful on the battlefield. The Ukrainians are still using Abrams in combat. They're still using Leopards and other NATO-provided tanks. But the role is not as significant as they once were. But again, in order to kind of reestablish the ability to use armor effectively, it's going to come back to how well you can maybe suppress, degrade, or destroy enemy UAV units. Without that, if you can't employ armor at mass, then it's not clear that breakthroughs, any kind of really significant rapid breakthrough, is achievable.
So these million-dollar machines are getting knocked out by drones that can cost about $500 each. Is the calculation getting to the point that the West might see just the futility of donating tanks?
They are less useful than they once were, but I wouldn't say they're futile. And again, some of this comes back to how well can you degrade and counter FPV and other kind of UAV teams. If you can't do it, any kind of vehicle is going to be at risk. And both sides have adapted accordingly.
So I'm curious, to what extent are other nations watching the UAV innovations in the war between Russia and Ukraine?
Oh, it's certainly happening. So obviously in the U.S., Secretary Hegseth, I think, announced maybe a few weeks ago that they're making changes to procure drones more rapidly. I think there's understanding now in the U.S. military that FPVs and these kind of commercial UAVs are a more mature weapon system than they were maybe in 2022, 2023. And these things are here to stay, and that they, despite the other kind of advantages the U.S. military has that maybe Ukraine and Russia lack, that there's still a role for these UAVs. At a minimum, we need to be able to counter them, because any kind of future conflict, whether it's against a nation state like China or it's against terrorist groups or different types of paramilitary groups, it's likely that FPVs will use against us, and we have to be able to counter those. So the U.S. is learning from this. I think China obviously is learning from this, because China is learning from lessons from Russia. And many of the UAVs, the commercial UAVs that are provided, are either with Chinese components or they're Chinese themselves. So China's certainly learning from this. North Korea was fighting against Ukraine and Kursk. North Korea is almost certainly going to be learning about this as well.
How much do you worry, Rob, that drones will make it easier for leaders to start conflicts? And are you expecting to see more of that?
So there's a risk that you could conduct more deniable operations. If we look at what Ukraine did with Operation Spiderweb, when they destroyed and targeted all those Russian strategic bombers, obviously that came from Ukraine, given the context. But you could look forward and think about a non-state actor or state actor could conduct that against another country, and they might have a degree of plausible deniability. So that could be a potential threat going forward. In terms of making conflicts more likely, a lot of countries that don't have air forces can compensate, and they can still have some degree of air power by using UAVs instead. So that's another kind of factor going forward. I'm not sure it will make wars more likely. I think right now, though, as the technology is very early, many countries will not fully understand what it means, right? They might become more confident in UAV capabilities. They might think that they can achieve a kind of quick, decisive victory if they think that they have leveraged this technology better than other sides. But, you know, that could also lead to mistakes.
Rob Lee is a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He joined us from Kyiv. Turkey is one of the fastest growing military exporters in the world and has the second largest standing army in NATO. And it's been throwing its weight behind regional conflicts in recent years. That includes selling, you guessed it, drones to Ukraine. The world's Duri Baskaran reports from a military hardware fair in Istanbul.
Half a century ago, Turkey imported a lot of its military hardware from the U.S., from other allies. But when it used that equipment to invade northern Cyprus in 1974, an angry American president hit Turkey with an arms embargo. Tom Waldwin is a defense sector analyst at the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
That experience is driving Turkey to reduce its reliance on foreign partners and have its own much more sovereign defense industrial capability, which gives it much greater freedom of action in foreign policy.
50 years later, Turkey is the 11th largest military exporter in the world. This year, it's set to export more than $8 billion worth of military hardware, a new record for the country. And there are a few better ways to see this in action than Istanbul's biennial International Defense Industry Fair. There's a ballistic missile that travels at 5 times the speed of sound, trucks packed with portable missile defense systems, and a bunker buster bomb that can penetrate 23 feet of concrete. A robot the size of a large dog prances about in a mock-up war zone. There is sand, large rocks, a military truck draped in camouflage fabric. This robot can navigate it all.
It's a quadriplegic unmanned ground vehicle.
Ümit Yavuz is a spokesperson for Bytes, a subsidiary of Turkey's largest defense company, and a maker of multiple military robot dogs. This one, about the size of a German Shepherd, can run up to 25 miles an hour, carry 40 pounds of explosives on its back, and sense toxic gases.
And this is the brand new CBRN integration that we developed. It's a sensor that detects chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear agents.
In practice, Yavuz says it's the kind of robot an army might use to go ahead of them in a dangerous enclosed space, like a cave. Batu Coşkun is a Turkish political analyst for Trends, a research firm based in Abu Dhabi.
Turkey's defense sector seems to be at a crossroads where they are moving towards more technologically advanced projects.
He says Turkish military hardware is less expensive than a lot of its competitors, but still reliable. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's willingness to enter foreign conflicts, like Syria, Libya, and Azerbaijan's takeover of Nagorno-Karabakh, allows him to demonstrate these weapons in real conflicts. On top of that, Turkey doesn't require approval from its parliament to let a sale go through.
And they're not subject to the same level of political scrutiny, so Erdogan's decision is often final.
Turkey has sold drones to Ethiopia and Morocco. In June, it inked a deal to sell fighter jets to Indonesia. Coşkun says Turkey's push to build and export more military hardware is also about its fears of its neighbors.
This need to improve Turkey's deterrence capabilities more widely, particularly related to the Israeli-Iran conflict.
Though the U.S. is still the world's largest military exporter, the industry is becoming more decentralized, and the full geopolitical impact isn't clear yet. Earlier this year, a Turkish firm was accused of sending arms and ammunition to the Sudanese army in violation of international sanctions. You can get a sense of Turkey's ambitions in the deals that collapse. Here's Tom Waldwin again from the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Turkey tried to sell an attack helicopter to Pakistan. That helicopter has an American engine. To export anything with U.S. technology, you need the U.S. government's approval.
The U.S. government did not approve, and the deal collapsed. But weapons made in Turkey with Turkish components aren't subject to the same restrictions. And Waldwin says even small sales of armed drones to countries that don't have them yet often pave the way for commercial deals, too.
Much more lucrative deals on construction, energy, port facilities that are then concluded subsequently because Turkey has made that demonstration of political commitment to that country's security problems.
For countries that have been turned away or overlooked by wealthier countries, that's a powerful relationship to forge. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Here at The World, we bring you the latest global news. It includes, as you know, some pretty heavy stuff. We also aim to bring you some joy. So it is exciting to announce that we're relaunching The World's GeoQuiz. If you're a longtime listener, you might remember when we used to feature this daily test of your knowledge of geography and news. Well, the GeoQuiz is back on our new YouTube channel, but this time it's testing my knowledge and Carolyn's, and our producers are not throwing us any softballs. You are strongly encouraged to play along to test your GeoIQ. When you do, leave us a comment and tell us if you got it right. You can find us on YouTube at The World News GBH. Fair warning, these geo quizzes are addictive, so you might as well subscribe now. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Togo in West Africa, a small sliver of a country sandwiched between Ghana and Benin. Tensions are rising in Togo as protests grow over a power grab by the country's dynastic leader. Faure Gnassingbé had been the country's president since 2005 and his father for more than 30 years before him. But Gnassingbé is now Togo's prime minister, not president. The government made that change without a public referendum. It gives Gnassingbé executive power with no term limits and no need to receive votes as long as his party gets a majority. That has sparked a wave of protests in the country's capital, Lomé. Farida Naburema is a Togolese activist living in exile. She has not disclosed her location as a security precaution. She told us today that the regime was trying to pull a PR stunt.
Interestingly, the position of President of the Republic is still existent in Togo, but it has been completely emptied of all his powers. Why did he do that? Because he wanted to push for a narrative. The narrative is that Togo has a new President of the Republic. And the president of the republic can only serve one term, which is true. They put a term limit on the role that has absolutely no power, while he himself transferred to the second presidential role, which is the actual role with all the powers and zero term limits and zero accountability.
So much of the anger being expressed is by young Togolese. They're concentrated in the capital. What kind of impact do they have on the rest of the population in the rest of the country?
The impact has actually been across the country. Even though the protests have been more present in the capital city, we are seeing young people participate as well digitally. The reason why it has not been possible for those in the other parts of the capital city to organize is because protests have been banned in Togo since 2020. So the regime took advantage of the COVID pandemic to ban all political gatherings in Togo. Protests, press conferences, and even town hall meetings. But those in the capital city are better equipped to organize in a very organic and decentralized manner. And they have been very successful at doing that. They have issued barricades to slow down the police when they are coming to attack them. And there have been a lot of retaliation from the security forces. In total, 7 people have been killed, but there are more than 20 people that are still missing. So there's suspicion that many others have been killed and been discarded, but their bodies just have not been found till today.
How would you say what's happening right now in Togo is different from previous efforts to oppose Faure Gnassingbé?
The main different thing now is that the protests are not organized and held by political parties. It is organized by young people, by bloggers, by musicians, by artists. And the regime has never faced a situation where the leaders of the movement are not physically present in Togo. At least the non-leaders of the movement are all living outside of the country. In the past, it was easier for them to go to the politicians and negotiate behind the scenes and to calm things down. But this time around, it is difficult for them to do that because the people who are at the forefront of this process are not people with political ambitions. These are young people who are fed up with decades of abuse and oppression and repression, and they just want change.
Farida, with the jihadist movement in the Sahel that extends into the north of Togo, Washington and the region want to be sure that the militants don't move further south to these heavily populated areas. Are countries in the West going to criticize an authoritarian move like what Faure Gnassingbé has done in Togo?
The sad thing that has happened in the case of Togo, because when the Faure Gnassingbé did his maneuver last year, some of us Togolese activists did reach out to different governments in the region and also governments in the West, explaining to them the dangers of this maneuver by the regime. But what we have noticed from Western nations overall is that they put their fight against jihadism and terrorism before the fight against authoritarianism and dictatorship. As a result, we have even been told by one official from a Western state that I will not mention, that they cannot afford to lose Togo. And what do they mean by that? Over the past years, we have seen military coups taking place in the region, and the militaries that were responsible for the coups have distanced themselves from Western nations. As a result, the West is trying as much as possible to keep its influence in the region and doesn't want to frustrate government that are seen as being loyal. And Fonya Sibe and his regime are among the government that are seen as being loyal to the West, most specifically France, which is our colonial power. But the reality is that what led to the coups in the Sahel was the citizens' frustration with the worsening of their condition, their economic conditions, their security conditions, and who were tired with the corruption and the mismanagement of their resources by their leaders. So we are facing the same situation in Togo. The people of Togo are fed up with the poverty, the rising poverty, with the rising corruption, with the huge level of impunity. And when the West actually put their military objectives before democratic principles, they end up getting neither of those. So it is important for Western nations to understand that achieving democracy and securing democratic gains is actually fundamental to achieving security for the region and achieving security for the whole world.
You were obviously referring to countries like Niger and Mali and Burkina Faso that have rejected Western powers. Where does all this go next, Farida?
It's hard to tell, but as an activist, I am always optimistic that it will end in the victory of the people of Togo being able to bring the change they have been fighting for so many decades, for which thousands have been killed, hundreds of thousands have been exiled. And we do hope to see that happening soon. We don't know how much long this we have to be involved in this struggle, but the level of determination and innovation and creativity that the young people of Togo are investing in this struggle is giving us immense hope.
That was Togolese activist Farida Nabourema speaking to us today from an undisclosed location about a wave of protests in Togo. We humans are, don't you know, part of the animal kingdom. But there are two places in the world that bring us even closer to beasts, places where humans are impersonating animals with good reason. Let me explain, starting in Japan. A man in a bear costume chased people as part of a safety drill this week, that following a spate of bear sightings and a few attacks. The drills were carried out by members of Japan's police force in the Tochigi Prefecture. They learned how to scare the animals off using firecrackers and how to safely approach an animal after it's been shot or tranquilized. In the video, the man in the bear costume looks deterred. Hey, I mean, they're throwing firecrackers at him. Meanwhile, in Europe, zookeepers in Prague have been impersonating vultures to save newborn birds, rejected by their parents. Prague Zoo birdkeeper Antonin Vidal says he uses puppets of vultures so their babies don't become dependent on humans or too comfortable with them. If a baby vulture gets too accustomed to human interaction, the zookeeper says it might not be capable of breeding when it grows up. The puppet feeding technique has been used to save two other kinds of birds before. Here's hoping it also works for vultures.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. Last week's votes in Congress to eliminate federal funding for public media are a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Taiwan is constantly on guard. It faces subtle and not so subtle reminders that China wants the small democratic island under its control. Chinese warships routinely ply the waters around Taiwan, and China sends fighter jets above. Military exercises, they say. Beijing also makes its presence known in Taiwan's bureaucracies. The government in Taipei is riddled with spies, and officials there know it. Here's The World's Patrick Nguyen.
A few months ago, a Taiwanese policy analyst named Fang Yuchen opened his inbox. He saw a disturbing email from an anonymous sender.
A person told me that, oh, I have all of your information, including your family members.
It contained details about his wife and his kids, followed by vague language about cooperating with future demands.
The email lists my address and including my family's birthdays and all of this information. So that is threatening.
Chen is a well-known professor at a university called Suzhou. He's also advised Taiwan's government on policy. He's got influence. So if this was a Chinese intelligence agency trying to scare him into doing its bidding, he would be a worthy target.
I do think that these kind of cases are just everywhere.
Chen ignored the email, but clearly others make different choices. Multiple top former intelligence officials in Taiwan claim there are roughly 5,000 people on the island spying for China.
China's attempt to do this kind of infiltration is quite pervasive. We have been infiltrated in a very high level.
Infiltrated at the highest levels. In the president's office, an advisor was selling national security secrets to China. He was indicted last month. Also in June, the government sentenced a 10-person spy ring inside Taiwan's military. On top of that, four soldiers on the president's security detail in March got prison terms for passing on documents about the president's whereabouts. That could help China take out the president if it wanted to. Beijing has released propaganda videos simulating its missiles blasting Taiwan. Some of the targets depicted have included presidential offices.
What we call this is decapitation warfare, okay? And you need the spies to do that.
Dennis Wilder is a professor at Georgetown University. He was also, for years, the chief China analyst at the CIA.
If China were to decide to invade, you would activate these agents. They would tell you where the leadership is, and you'd either strike them by drone, you'd strike them by missile.
Wilder says, case in point, Israel recently used this technique against Iran's military leadership to devastating effect. Wilder says many Taiwanese military officers and officials, like people everywhere, can be coerced. China's intelligence bureau, like the CIA, is really good at finding those people and exploiting their personal failings.
Some people get into trouble drinking. They get into debt. They have a terrible marriage.
And when a troubled individual also has high-level access to, say, blueprints of a military base, it's game on.
You say, you know, I'd like to help you out of your problems, but you got to do me some favors. you know, I can help you, but I need a little help too.
Fang Yuchen, the academic, has studied this too. He says Beijing intelligence operatives usually start with small requests, but eventually escalate.
Step by step, they give them some more difficult tasks with very high payoff.
$3,000 for photos of internal military documents, up to $20,000 for presidential security plans. These are real examples from recent trials. There were 64 cases in which Taiwan rooted out spies last year. That's up from just 10 a few years ago. Chen says the 5,000 spies number seems credible to him, even if it's impossible to prove. Either way, that big, scary number might jolt people awake.
The purpose of telling the public is to raise awareness of this.
But many still don't take the problem seriously. In recent years, hundreds of Taiwanese politicians have put themselves at risk by accepting cheap or free tours of mainland China, sponsored by the Chinese government. Dennis Wilder says that presents a golden opportunity for blackmail.
Somebody comes into China, they meet a prostitute, they take them to the room, and the next morning, the Ministry of State Security is at your door saying, "It is a shame that you violated Chinese law. Here are the pictures." This is very common on the Chinese side. They've tried it on me. I know it. I know it very well.
Taiwan's spy problem isn't just a problem for Taiwan. Ideally, the U.S., which might defend Taiwan if it's attacked, would be able to share its war plans with the Taiwanese military. Wilder says that's not in the cards. Those plans would likely fall right into Beijing's hands. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
El Salvador has become a dangerous place to call home if you are a critic of its president, Nayib Bukele. More than 100 human rights activists and journalists have been forced into exile from El Salvador in the past year. Harassment and legal threats drove the country's best-known human rights organization, Cristosal, to announce its departure last week. We reached out to Cristosal's executive director, Noah Bullock, to find out how his group made the difficult decision to leave. We reached him at Cristosal's new office in Guatemala's capital, Guatemala City. Noah, your work inside El Salvador had never been easy. What was the tipping point exactly that sent you and about 20 of your colleagues packing last week?
Well, that's right. I think since the beginning of the Bukele regime, we've been subjected to different harassment, legal, financial, espionage, monitoring and surveillance. And that all got normalized, but there was definitely a tipping point when they detained our colleague Ruth Lopez, who was a member of our leadership team and led our anti-corruption unit. And about a week later, they detained one of the other public voices that was defending Ruth and denouncing the illegalities of her detention, Enrique Anaya. And it became clear to us that, you know, we were a direct target of persecution. Other members of our leadership team received threats. They were told that their names were on blacklists of people that were going to be detained. We received visits at our homes from police officers at night, then later stayed outside monitoring. And then they approved like a Russian-style foreign agents law that has the clear objective of controlling the activities of the population, but also punishing and criminalizing organizations like ours. We felt like we were forced to choose between exile and prison. And at the end of the day, we decided that we're no good to anybody, much less our colleagues who are now political prisoners, if we're all in prison.
It sounds like this harassment campaign was pretty relentless. Was it happening basically day to day, and that's why you had to leave?
It was more the escalation, the idea that Cristosal was being persecuted to send a message to the whole population, that dissent, denouncements of abuses wouldn't be tolerated.
So you mentioned two of your colleagues were detained, Ruth Lopez and Enrique Denaya. Are they still detained?
They're still detained. And in that same 10-day period, really, there were four human rights defenders that were detained. One was an evangelical pastor that was working in a community, and the other one was a lawyer that represented them. Now they've been transferred to prisons and don't have access to their families or lawyers, and that constitutes a situation of forced disappearance, which sadly is the reality for, you know, over 86,000 Salvadorans who have been arbitrarily detained and disappeared into prisons under President Bukele's state of exception.
Hmm. So back in El Salvador, are there blacklists with specific people targeted for harassment or detention?
That's one of the things that's really a detonator for a lot of the people who decided to flee the country, is that they were warned by people that their names were on lists. It's difficult sometimes to verify if the list exists or not, but the detentions of these human rights defenders demonstrates the intent of the state to target human rights defenders. And like I said, it's not just the fear of being detained, it's the fear of being detained and being unable to defend yourself and then be subjected to forced disappearance and possibly the torture that's being well documented in the Salvadoran prisons.
And yet, Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele remains extremely popular. How do you explain why so many Salvadorans support his regime?
Majorities of Salvadorans say they support the president, and the similar majorities say that they would be afraid to tell you if they didn't. So you have a Salvadoran population that says they support the president, but they live under constant fear of him.
Well, this week, there were 252 Venezuelans who were released from the infamous Salvadoran prison known as CICOT. They were part of an exchange for the release of 10 American citizens. And since their release, several of these former prisoners have spoken about the conditions in that facility. What have they described?
Guards often warn people when they enter the Salvadoran prisons that they won't leave walking. And that's what the Venezuelans are saying. They were denied access to food, to water, to medicine. They were beaten regularly. And we also are hearing testimonies of people who suffered sexual violence.
Noah, you were born in the U.S., but you're a naturalized Salvadoran. Does that status make you especially vulnerable, or does it offer you protection?
I don't know. You know, just in general, human rights defenders and journalists in Central America have been supported in the past by the U.S., for example. I believe that the United States was important in defending civic space and democratic actors in the region, but the U.S. has recently withdrawn from that role. And in the case of El Salvador, allied with the autocrat that's now our aggressor and persecutes us.
So, Noah, as you and other civil society activists leave El Salvador, what's that going to do to the country itself?
Well, exile is a form of political violence. It's first, you know, directed at the people that suffer persecution and are forced to flee, but it also has an impact in the societies that they leave. The message that's being sent to El Salvador is that people who dissent won't be tolerated. But I also know El Salvador and the Salvadoran people, and I think that history tells us that repression never is successful in stopping the human rights movement. These are things that people feel deeply in their lives and their families. The dreams of a better world, aspirations for freedom, are things that repression has never been able to stop.
You also have to recognize, though, that your departure means there are fewer eyes and fewer people calling out the repression.
That's right. But we think that the people who have been who enter our programs as victims oftentimes leave as leaders. Leaders of the human rights movement. And so the human rights movement in El Salvador isn't limited to one NGO. I truly believe that we will be able to support them and keep accompanying them, and the human rights movement can't be stopped with repression.
Noah Bullock is the executive director of the human rights organization Cristosal. We reached him at Cristosal's new office in Guatemala City. Lagos, the dense commercial capital of Nigeria, is building a satellite city off its Atlantic coast. It's intended to protect residents from rising sea levels and to provide sorely needed new homes and modern infrastructure. It is a multi-billion dollar project, but so far, critics say it's been a dud. The world's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel has our story.
The project is ambitious, to say the least.
Echo Atlantic is rapidly growing into a reality, with daily progress towards the vision of developing a new flagship city for Lagos, Nigeria.
Built on 4 square miles of reclaimed land and protected by a massive seawall called the Great Wall of Lagos, Echo Atlantic, often referred to as the Dubai of Africa, is supposed to fundamentally transform life for up to 250,000 residents.
Every aspect of the city's infrastructure has been carefully planned and implemented to the highest standards.
And it's all safe from flooding thanks to that seawall and a high-tech drainage system. Things that Lagos, a city of 20 million that's rapidly growing and literally sinking, sorely needs.
Lagos generally as a city, there is a perennial problem of flooding.
Jola Ajibade grew up in Lagos and says as a kid, the 1-2 punch of torrential downpours combined with rising sea levels would often make life unbearable. Streets would flood to chest level. People who didn't know how to swim would drown.
All of our properties, clothing, pictures. I don't have any picture of my childhood or any video or anything like that because it's been destroyed by the flood. And I remember that every year we would buy, you know, new mattresses. We would replace TVs. It was just a drain on my family's income and resources, but we had no other alternative at the time. It was what my parents could afford where we were living.
Inspired by her experience as a child, Ajibade is now a professor at Emory University, studying the effects of climate change on vulnerable people in megacities like Lagos, where the infrastructure can't keep up with population growth. She says on paper, Echo Atlantic, with its towering apartment buildings, pristine roadways, and public parks, appears to be exactly what the city needs. A silver bullet capable of not just protecting against climate change, but also fighting it with new green spaces, housing, and eco-friendly transport powered by electricity rather than fossil fuels.
But the question is, when you look very deeply into both the production of those projects, the amount of energy that it takes to produce them, the amount of money that has been invested, and then the implication, both in terms of economic impact on communities and who are the winners and losers, you see a very different picture, which does not align with the claims of the property developers.
The developers and public officials behind the project did not return repeated requests for comment, but on their YouTube page, you can see where things stand more than a decade after Echo Atlantic first broke ground in 2008. In a video posted just 3 months ago, the camera moves from construction site to construction site as music bumps in the background, showing massive luxury buildings surrounded not by greenery, but dry, barren land. There are new roads, but not many cars are using them. So far, Ajibade says Echo Atlantic appears only to be catering to the wealthy elite, while the people living outside its walls still face housing and service shortages. Developers have also come under fire for displacing poor communities and exacerbating flooding in nearby areas with redirected seawater. Meantime, many of its buildings are still vacant, and a growing number of experts say Echo Atlantic has failed to deliver. So what went wrong?
If a project is excessively top-down and it fails to engage the most vulnerable people in its development and its creation, it's going to fail.
Alize Carrere is a Nairobi-based researcher who studies so-called climatopias, transformative projects like Echo Atlantic that promise to be climate-resilient cities of the future.
Transformation is really hard to implement, and everybody has, generally speaking, good intentions. But sometimes when we implement these projects, they don't always pan out the way that we had intended when we had them on this beautiful, you know, drafting table.
She says the problem with mega developments is that when push comes to shove, they tend to think too big.
Right now, I think that when we talk about new city projects, starting at smaller scales, such that people can be engaged and that these processes can be participatory, is critical.
Echo Atlantic, Carrere says, might offer a gleaming vision of the future, but a true climatopia needs to consider the people most affected by climate change. And for now, those people still live outside the project's walls. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. South African musician Bakiti Khumalo. You may not immediately recognize his name, but you very likely know his sound, and one riff in particular. Paul Simon's 1986 hit, You Can Call Me Al, from his seminal album Graceland. That is Bakiti Khumalo on bass. He graces, shall we say, all of Graceland. Safe to say the album would have been decidedly less edgy were it not for Khumalo's bass.
I'm going to Graceland, Graceland, Memphis, Tennessee, I'm going to Graceland.
Paul Simon's current tour is called A Quiet Celebration. It's reconnecting music fans with songs from Graceland. I recently caught up with Bakiti Khumalo during a break from the road. He recalls that when he first got the call 40 years ago to play on the album, he really didn't know who Paul Simon was.
Find out that Paul Simon is a musician from America. But when my boss told me he was from Jamaica, he didn't say Jamaica, Queens, so I thought he was a rasta. when he say talk about the song Mother and Child Reunion, and I thought, oh yeah, I know the song.
No, I would not give you false hope on this strange and mournful day. But the mother and child reunion is only a motion away.
Once Bakiti Khumalo made the connection, he was all in.
And then I go to the studio. When I get to the studio, it was a bunch of people. And Paul was there, and then I met Paul, and he told me how much he loved what I was doing. And that really gave me a green light to whatever happens, you know. And when you have a situation like this, you have sweet and sour. So I choose the sweet side, but the sour side was the political situation in South Africa back then, you know. But I really didn't pay attention on them. Like, I'm not dealing with this right now. I'm going to take the music part of it and move forward.
Well, I want to talk about your bass playing in a moment, but as long as we're there, I mean, Paul Simon recorded Graceland in 1986 in South Africa, very controversial at the time because boycotts over apartheid were gaining strength. How did you decide to play on the album?
It was because Paul, the sound that he had on those traditional recordings, that really, he wanted that. But I had to fight the record label in South Africa because my thing, I wasn't signed with the label. I was a session musician. Whenever I'm needed, I'll show up and play. But I was not with the part of recording label. So when it came and then the recording company, they kind of like tried to take over everything. They want to bring their own musicians and they couldn't play. And Paul was not the sound that he wanted. He wanted the sound that I introduced. So for me, it was like I'm a side man and I'm a bass player and I want to go distance. I don't want to just be a South African bass player. I think I have a talent. I just need some support to help me. And Paul came through. He loved our music. He was not taking an advantage of our music.
Let's talk about the music and those notes. I want to break down the bass line in You Can Call Me Al. It is such a cool riff, and every time it comes on the album, I'm just there, you know, like doing the air bass. Was that you and Paul Simon coming up with that together, or was that one of those spontaneous in-the-moment brainstorms you had? Like, where'd you come up with that?
I asked Paul, and he gave me an opportunity. He says, hey, do it, you know. If it's something that it's good, we'll keep it, you know. And I played, and they stopped me. They told me, that's it.
I'm speaking with South African bass player Bakidi Khumalo. You've recorded with a slew of artists through the years, Cyndi Lauper, there's also Herbie Hancock, and some traditional Irish tunes with American fiddle player Eileen Ivers. This is Gravel Walk off of Ivers' 1999 album, Crossing the Bridge. Bagidi, talk about crossing bridges, because Paul Simon got you rocking a Zydeco bass line on Graceland, but was it a challenge to find the groove in a traditional Irish tune?
Yes, I would say yes. It was a little bit challenging because it's hectic. You know, the music is moving so much in the bass. But, you know, I love challenges. My life is to, like, you know, chase the challenges and face the challenges.
Speaking of challenges, I know Paul Simon has had some severe hearing loss. How has that complicated things on stage during the Quiet Celebration tour?
Man, this man, nobody knows like I do. I mean, I've spent 40 years watching him create. He loves music, and he can figure out anything to put it together. And just to watch him, how he creates, and he talks to the band, and we play with the dynamics that's comfortable for him.
I wonder if he counts more on your bass line for the vibration almost. I know dancers often rely on those heavy bass lines to guide them.
No. The bass line, he knows I'm secured. I'm safe. I'm carrying the whole group without being so present. But my thing is to give him enough that he can feel, not hear it, but feeling it. And then same thing with the drums, because the drums are loud and, you know, the bass can be adjusted, the drums you can adjust. So I'm adjusting to what the drums are doing and give him what he needs, the bass, without being loud. And we play, you know, pretty good, you know.
It was a slow day and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light.
South African bass player Bakidi Khumalo. He's out on the road performing again with Paul Simon on his Quiet Celebration tour. Music that celebrates in part the groundbreaking album Graceland, which heavily featured Khumalo.
The way the camera follows us in slow-mo, the way we look to a song, the way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracles and wonder, and don't cry, baby, don't cry.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and also now on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. That's all one word. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. We're back with you again on Monday.
This is a long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo, the way we look to a song, oh yeah. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder and all pride.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Nicole and David Berger, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Anne and John Newman, and Lawrence Wilkinson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.